In the years since the Iraq War, the U.S. military has added hundreds of working dog teams across its branches of service. It all started on this day in 1942. It's National Canine Veterans Day, and we're learning about the role of military working dogs on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Retired Air Force Colonel Doug Miller is the Military Working Dog Program Manager for the U.S. Department of Defense. He's a former dog handler and joins us from Lackland Air Force Base in Texas. Colonel Miller, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good morning.
Well, help us understand the scope of your work, your position with U.S. military working dogs. What do you oversee?
Well, primarily, I am a policy guy. I write and set policy for all the Department of Defense to go by with the military working dogs, both through the procurement and production side at the 341st Training Squadron here on Lackland, out to each of the, because after a dog goes through training, it is shipped out to each of the services that have requirements, four services. And then each of those four services write operational policy for their dogs. I hold biannual joint service military working dog committee meetings with program managers from each of the services to determine direction we should go, research we should do with the dogs, disposition of dogs, all kinds of policy that we set during those meetings. And we also invite outsiders in, like the ATF and the Department of State and many others that have come that also have dogs that come and talk to us.
There's evidence that dogs around the world have been part of armies for centuries. What do modern American military working dogs do?
Well, for the most part, the Department of Defense dogs are both patrol trained, and they're either explosive detection dogs or drug detection dogs. Prior to 9/11, we were much more heavily on the drug detection side, and we were doing a lot of assistance with the border mission on the southwest border of the United States for drug interdiction. And after 9/11, we pretty much flipped the numbers that we had explosive detection versus, and we're running about 3-to-1 explosive detection mission versus drug detection now within the military.
What are the numbers like for the number of military working dogs in the military these days?
Well, we have over 1,800 authorizations for military working dogs across all the four services. And those consist of primarily patrol and drug detection, or patrol and explosive detection. But we do have a few mine dogs that the Army has with their Corps of Engineers. And we have some specialized search dogs that primarily work with the Marine Corps mission that do off-leash detection out a couple hundred meters away from them. And then the Marines also have a combat tracker dog, which that dog just does tracking.
Are a lot of these dogs deployed to combat areas, or do they spend a majority of their time in other situations and on other types of teams?
Yes, the majority of their time is at a home station. The only time that we're heavy in deployments is when we're in some type of armed conflict. When we were heavily deployed into Iraq and Afghanistan recently, in the last few years anyway, then we were more heavily deployed. But the day-to-day mission of most of our military working dogs is to support the military police or security forces for the Air Force or Master of Arms for the Navy. And they have a law enforcement-type mission or security-type mission day-to-day at that installation. But we do heavily support the Secret Service with protection of the President and Vice President and other dignitaries. So we do temporary missions all around the world, really, when he travels or other foreign dignitaries. And we support the Department of State as well on those missions. But day-to-day, it's pretty much a law enforcement or security-type mission at home station.
We're talking with retired Air Force Colonel Doug Miller. He is the Military Working Dog Program Manager for the Defense Department. He's a former dog handler, joining us from Lackland Air Force Base in Texas on this National Canine Veterans Day. You can join in the conversation with your questions, with your experiences on military working dogs at 800-642-1234. Have you served in the military? We're working dogs part of your unit or another one that you worked with? What should people know about the role of dogs in military operations? Call in at 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Colonel Miller, when does training start for a military working dog? Walk us through that role of training.
Well, for the dogs themselves, and we really have two tracks. We have the handler training, which is about 55 days of coursework where we teach a handler everything about a dog, medical care for a dog, care and feeding for a dog, and just basic handling of a dog. And then we have the four-legged military working dog course, which is approximately 120 days it takes to take a dog, a green dog, what we call it green dog, when we get in with no training, from start to finish. They start them with obedience training, because obedience, if you don't have obedience in the dog, then it's hard to do any other kind of training with them. So we start with basic obedience, and then they go into detection training, because it takes a little bit longer to do detection training than the patrol side. So they do detect, and we don't want to invest all that time and lose a dog because they can't make it through training, and then just have patrol dogs, because we have very few just patrol authorizations within the military. So they go through detection training, which can take about 75 days less for some dogs. They get it. They've got a real good high drive, and they do much better through that training. And then they finish that block of training, and they go over to the patrol side and go through patrol training. And then once the 341st Training Squadron has deemed them as a qualified dog or a basic level qualified dog, we find out which service is in the greatest need for a requirement, and then we arrange shipment of that dog out to that unit.
Does the dog have to be a certain breed or have a specific temperament?
Well, we've gone through many breeds over the years of dogs, but we have settled pretty much on the German Shepherd, Dutch Shepherd, and our favorite really is the Belgian Malinois, which looks kind of like a shepherd, but it seems to be more athletic, doesn't have maybe some of the hip problems, and a very, very high drive dog. When we have our puppies, a lot of times we call them Maligators because they have this urge to bite and chew, and they're just very, very active. About the most active toddler you would find. They'll clear a desk or grab something and chew it. You just got to watch them all the time. But, yes, and then we look for the temperament. We socialize them early. We are looking for a dog that doesn't have fear, fear of obstacles or their environment, stairs, things that they'll encounter, slick floors, things like that. No fear of loud noises like gunfire or artillery or things like that. So we train them in those areas. And if they do have a fear for that, they're probably not going to make it into the program. And we do a lot of that in the evaluation. And they need to have a high drive for the ball or a Kong or something that they're chewing on, because that's their reward when they find explosives or drugs.
How does the U.S. keep track of military working dogs?
Well, we have a management system that goes every dog that we've purchased since we've started the program and has received a tattoo and been entered into the program, I can track and find out where it is, whether it's been dispositioned out or where it's at the current time, and if it's certified. If it's with a current handler and they're certified as a team, we have a working dog management system that all four services are plugged into that and manage their programs internally with that. And then the 341st, which is responsible for procurement, training, and disposition of dogs, tracks it, because we do congressional reporting as well, and that's a good source for us, that database.
How long might these dogs be in service?
Well, the typical working life of a military working dog is to about 9 to 10 years of age. And we generally train them initially from 1 to 3 years of age. That's when their training starts. So there are dogs that go longer than that.
It just depends.
There are dogs that go shorter because of medical problems or they just lost their will to work or whatever it was. Sometimes we lose them sooner than that, but for the most part, their working life is 9 to 10 years.
We're learning about military working dogs on this Canine Veterans Day. Retired Air Force Colonel Doug Miller is with us. He manages the Defense Department's Military Working Dog Program. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you served in the military where working dogs were part of your unit or another one that you worked with? What should people know about the role of dogs in military operations? Have you seen the Canine Corps make a difference? Call in or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation after a news update right here on the Ideas Network. On this day in 1942, the Army started training dogs for the newly established Canine Corps. When the U.S. entered World War II, the American Kennel Association and a group called Dogs for Defense began a movement to mobilize dog owners to donate healthy and capable animals to the U.S. Army. On this Canine Veterans Day, we're learning about the role of military working dogs. The Defense Department's Military Working Dog Program Manager is retired Air Force Colonel Doug Miller. He stays with us for the conversation. He's a former dog handler and is joining us from Lackland Air Force Base in Texas. Gathering your insights on military dogs at 800-642-1234. Have you handled a dog in the armed forces? What's the relationship you've developed with the dog? How do you describe the connection between service members and service animals? Call in or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Let's go to Chris, who's waiting in Adams. Good morning, Chris.
Good, very dark, cold morning. I feel sorry for you guys because you get up so early and do this. And it's gotten worse in the past weekend, hasn't it? Okay, I have a great story. And I ran into a guy in a bar, and this is Wisconsin, so we do that. He was a unit coordinator person, a sergeant in a unit that had a German Shepherd and a trainer that went out in advance of them in the jungle in Vietnam. And they got sniped out. The dog got hurt. The trainer got killed. They had doggy hospitals in Vietnam, and so the dogs went into the hospital, and the guys were out in the jungle for weeks and weeks and weeks while the dog recovered, et cetera, et cetera. And it was the fall of Saigon, and everything got crazy, and they were evacuating everybody. And so the Army told them that they had to leave the dogs there. And this guy went to the doggy hospital, confiscated the dogs, took them onto the plane. They told them that they couldn't bring them back to the country. He said, lock and load, guys, and they pointed their guns at various parts of the plane.
Chris, I want to interrupt this story because I'm sure Colonel Miller has heard this story before. Colonel Miller, can you tell us what happened in Vietnam?
Well, I don't know about this specific incident, and I've heard rumors that a few dogs did get kind of smuggled back, but we left a lot of dogs in Vietnam. We didn't really have many options because of the fast vacation we had to do out of there. But I will assure you that we do not do that anymore, and haven't since Vietnam anyway. Our handlers and dogs deploy together and they come home together, and they are at their home station with and I know there were many rumors during the conflict that we were leaving dogs behind, but we never left any of our dogs behind.
There is some misinformation out there that these dogs are considered equipment. How would you debunk that?
Well, at one time, probably back during that time frame, and the way that dogs were procured and purchased, it was kind of a logistics item, and it could be that the overall military thought of them as equipment because they had a national stock number. but they have never been equipment to the handler and the people that are working intimately with the dogs. And we've changed all of our policy and regulations concerning dogs, and now they are considered a high-value critical asset. They are a force multiplier. They are a force protection asset, and they are like the best friend probably of the handler. Many times it's lonely duty out there, and you're talking to your dog more than you're talking to other people. The scary part's when you expect them to answer back.
Chris, thanks so much for the call. Colonel Miller, not everyone is prepared to work with a dog during military operations. What makes a good dog handler?
Well, a good dog handler is somebody probably that grew up around dogs, doesn't really have a fear of dogs, because sometimes your dog can have an attitude, and you've got to be the alpha. You have to be the master of that dog. So we try to do a screening process with all of our handlers before they go to school, and then they're evaluated, of course, on those things while they're in school. But primarily, you got to be patient, because a lot of times training is repetitive. It's over and over and over, and you can't get really frustrated. You just have to be a little bit smarter than your dog. And sometimes that's pretty difficult, because we've got some pretty smart dogs. But it takes a patient handler. It takes a handler that understands and is willing to understand his dog. And a relationship is bonded, because those dogs are lifesavers and have done it many times in the field.
What did the U.S. Army see in the role of dogs dating back to 1942 when the Canine Corps came to be?
Well, I think they saw them initially not so much like we use them today, because we had a different kind of conflict back then. And so dogs were used a lot of times behind the line to move things around or to take messages from one location to another. And it really wasn't formalized until about the Korea time frame, when we started using sentry dogs, which that meant nobody was going to get near you. That was a force protection asset, and those dogs were pretty much out of control. It was one handler, one dog, and when that dog bit, he wasn't coming off till you pried him off. And then about 1968, we decided to go a different direction, and that was to use like police dogs and make them into patrol dogs, where they were under control. When they do an attack, we could actually call them off from the attack. If the perpetrator stopped before the dog got to them, we could call the dog off and not even have to have a bite. But if a person stopped resisting, you call the dog off and the dog will come off. But the sentry dogs prior to that didn't. You'd have to pry them off of there. And it was difficult then when a handler would leave to maybe develop that relationship with a new handler. It took a lot longer period than it does now. When a new handler comes in to take over a dog, it usually doesn't take very long at all for them to develop a relationship and go through a certification.
What does that strong connection look like between a handler and a military working dog?
Well, it's your patrol partner. You know, a lot of times we have two-person patrols out there in some of our security patrols or law enforcement patrols, and usually with the dog handler, it's just you and the dog. So you develop a relationship with that dog because you depend upon them. I mean, they're the ones that are looking for something that you couldn't even smell if you were standing beside it, and they can smell it across the room, across an area. They have so much better senses than the handler does, and the handler knows that that dog is going to protect them. So it's a strong bond between the handler and the dog. And we see that over and over when it comes time to adopt dogs at the end of their useful life. Handlers usually get them, and the bond goes on and on.
What is about that sense of smell that can really carry through on missions where you've seen it mission critical?
Well, they smell in parts per billion, whereas we can't detect something from 2 feet away. And I have seen dogs respond on some explosives training aids in a ammo can 100 yards away, and the dog is running across the field and is 30 yards from that ammo can. But when they get in the scent plume, when the air is blowing that scent down, they're going with the wind, and they get in that plume at all, and they pick up the scent, they'll stop, turn towards the scent, and then they'll quarter their way into the scent the closest they can, and then they'll give you a response for an alert. And it's just amazing what they can do. And we have not found any kind of technology that can duplicate what they can find or what they can do. And they can do the same thing with the human scent. They do it with tracking. Hours-old tracks, they'll find it. They can do it. You send them into a building, they'll find an individual in a building hiding in a closet or something like that. They'll work until they find them.
And are they pretty predictable in terms of being able to track a scent once they learn something?
Yes.
Is it relatively unfailing?
Yes, they are very, very good at it. But as with anything that you have a special skill, it takes repetitive training. You continue to do training. You continue on different surfaces and things like that that could throw a dog off. You just continue training until the dog gets it down and it's just second nature for him.
We're talking with retired Air Force Colonel Doug Miller. He is the Military Working Dog Program Manager for the U.S. Department of Defense, a former dog handler. He's joining us from Lackland Air Force Base in Texas. You can join this conversation at 800-642-1234. How have you seen military working dogs in action? Have you handled a dog in the armed forces? What's the relationship you developed with that dog? How do you describe the connection between service members and service animals? 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Colonel Miller, what are the expectations for other service members alongside handlers and military working dogs? Because those handlers and the military working dogs have a very special bond. So what about the dynamics of the rest of the unit?
Well, it can depend on pretty much the environment where you're at. Like in deployed locations, oftentimes if you're out in tents or somewhere in an austere environment, many times the dog and the handler end up sleeping on the same cot. And if your dog is not a real strong, aggressive type nature, sometimes the rest of the guys in your immediate unit will also get a chance to maybe pet your dog and get close to your dog, because dogs for deployed members are like a contact back from home. It's a loyal partner, and they just enjoy petting them. It calms them down and everything else. But some of our dogs can't be petted like that. They are true to their handler. That is the person they're protecting, and you just got to tell those guys, well, you can't pet him, but, you know.
But you can look.
look,
but don't touch.
See our relationship, but you can't have one with them.
How do the dogs respond in the field if something does happen to their handler?
Normally, they're very protective, and sometimes it takes somebody with some guts, or somebody else maybe that was a close friend of that person that has gotten closer to the dog, to get the dog away from the handler, because they'll just stay there and protect them, even once they're injured.
The situations military working dogs enter can be incredibly intense. What prepares dogs and their human companions to work together in these highly intense situations?
Well, it's primarily repetitive training. And when we are going to do deployments, we do pre-deployment training. And we have locations where we have mock villages and similar environments. Like out in Yuma, Arizona, we do training out there, Fort Bliss, Texas, where the dogs face the kind of different environment that they're going to be going into, and they're going to face some of the same kind of scenarios with people, role players in the scenarios, explosives planted in different locations, and gunfire, loud explosions, those kinds of things, to just prepare the dog for those kinds of things. And give them helicopter rides, too, because oftentimes they're dropped off with a helicopter somewhere.
Let's go to Doug now, joining us from Ironwood, Michigan. Good morning, Doug.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. Go ahead.
Well, I trained at Lackland in 1969, graduated in March of 69. most of the, there was 12 in our class. Four went to, when they graduated, went to Vietnam. Four of us went to Guam as part of the ArcLight mission. And then I think four were what they call TDY. They were actually from permanent bases, and they just came to train. Most of the dog handlers, we were all what was called sentry dog handlers. We guarded resources. The patrol dog didn't come into place until, I think, 1972. Excuse me. And I did transition. I went back to Lackland, and I trained for the patrol dog in 1972.
Doug, what was that relationship like as you worked with the dogs?
Well, I was very lucky. I had a dog that had already been trained, and she was permanently assigned to Guam. Her name was Cindy, and she was just excellent. I mean, she knew the obstacle course so well that she would just run it on her own. I didn't even have to really coax her to do anything. She was the old sentry dog, so they were trained to attack. And it took me 3 days just to get in, to get her out of the kennel, to even take her for a walk.
Mm.
And once we formed that bond, she would have laid her life down for me. She would have done anything for me. We had such a connection.
Doug, thank you so much. I want to get Colonel Miller to respond to you.
Yes, that sounds familiar from the sentry dogs. And it was early 70s when we actually started in the schoolhouse with the patrol dog. They first started the concept in 68, and then they decided upon it and then went to the patrol dogs. And, you know, his class sounds similar to the one that I went through in 1978 with 12 dog handlers. And at that time, the handlers themselves would train a green dog on patrol, and then that dog would get shipped to the field if it got certified during that period that you did the training.
Let's go to Richard now in Lone Rock. Hi, Richard.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call. And thank you, Colonel Miller, for making this topic aware to the American public. I was a dog handler in the Iraq War, and I can tell you that everything that you're saying is absolutely true, and perhaps even a little bit on the light side as far as the bond that's created between you and that animal. I can't imagine losing a dog. Unfortunately, I never had. They become a part of your family. It's almost like a marriage. I told the interviewer when she picked up my call that it kind of falls like this when you're in the field. Your best asset is your gun. Your second best asset is your dog. They are that important to the handler. And when you see the team working, when they're spot on and they're working, it's a thing of beauty. It's hard to describe if you haven't been there, but Colonel Miller understands what I'm saying.
Richard, thank you so much, and we're short on time. Colonel Miller, what does the future hold for military working dogs very quickly?
We are going to continue with what we started with. We're going to continue to look for the right explosives aids that we should be training dogs on that will last the longest and continue the type of training we do. We are only going to grow, I think, in numbers as the Transportation Security Administration trains right alongside us, and their program is growing exponentially. So the requirement for dogs is always going to be there. There will not be a technology that will replace them.
Colonel Miller, thank you so much for taking the time with us.
Thank you.
Retired Air Force Colonel Doug Miller is the Military Working Dog Program Manager for the Defense Department. He's a former dog handler, joined us from Lackland Air Force Base in Texas. When we come back, we'll learn about animal-assisted therapy and Operation Heal at work right here in Wisconsin. Stay with us. The news is next. On On this Canine Veterans Day, we're learning about the role of dogs in service. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're going to explore a program that's based right here in Wisconsin. It's called Operation Heal, focuses on animal-assisted therapy to nurture children in a holistic way. Cindy Brosig served 9 years active duty in the U.S. Air Force Nurse Corps. She used her GI Bill benefits to earn a master's in nursing with an emphasis on animal-assisted therapy. She and her dog Ted are a registered therapy dog team. And Cindy, welcome to the program. Oh, Cindy, can you hear us? Hi, Cindy, can you hear us?
Yes, hi, good morning.
Good morning. So can you tell us, what is animal-assisted therapy?
Yes, great question. Animal-assisted therapy is a more formal version of therapy dogs visiting hospitals and nursing homes and schools. So what we use are goal-based programming or sessions, and we measure outcomes for patients or clients.
So what are these goals? Explain what the goals would be.
So a simple goal for someone with a physical disability would be perhaps we're trying to get fine motor control. We're getting them to learn how to use a toothbrush, again, by holding a toothbrush. So dogs can be used as a motivating factor as far as, so why don't you go ahead and hold a toothbrush to brush the dog's teeth, versus, you know, just holding on to a brush in general to get the fingers to process. It seems that when the connection from the brain and the eyes, there's more motivation when working with a dog.
Well, you have a dog who is Ted. Can you explain who Ted is?
Yes, Ted is a rescue from Tennessee. We adopted him at 4 months old. We did do a DNA test on him, and he is part shepherd, part coonhound, part corgi, and part chow chow.
And what is his role as an official therapy dog? Oh, Cindy, can you hear us? I think we're having some problems here with Cindy's line talking about animal-assisted therapy on this hour of the morning show. And if you have had a therapy dog that has changed your family, maybe your kid struggled with a parent's deployment, what did it mean to connect with a dog? Have you met Ted from Operation Heal? When did you cross paths? You can call in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Perhaps you're a veteran who's found strength in a therapy animal. Are you a spouse or a military child who feels the benefits of unconditional affection from a therapy dog? Call in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas@wpr.org. Cindy, do we have you back?
I'm here.
Oh, good. I think we had some connection issues. So you were telling us about Ted. He is an official therapy dog. What are Ted's credentials?
Well, we started with basic obedience as a puppy, and we got to test for his canine good citizen test. And after that, knowing his personality, and that was through a lot of our dog trainers, through classes, we thought, well, we'll go ahead and do the therapy dog test. And he was such a good fit as far as being gentle around people and willing to go and meet with them.
And so tell us about Operation Heal. When did that begin?
That program was created during my time getting my master's degree in nursing. I focused on using animal-assisted therapy in different populations, whether it was female veterans, service members, and ultimately military kids.
And so how does Ted work with kids?
So we do both animal-assisted therapy and then animal-assisted activities. And so primarily we get requested to visit classrooms where military kids are part of the school. And it's always interesting because we give them a platform to share their experience and to talk about their service member, because often military kids keep silent. They're afraid perhaps of telling a classmate that their dad or mom, aunt or uncle is in the military, because there's so much as far as, you know, the movies depicting that Army and Air Force and military people are killing machines. So it's sometimes hard for them to explain that perhaps their parent is an engineer and not in the act of fighting.
The dog is an avenue for the children to open up?
Absolutely, yes. So not only does it lower their stress level, but it's offering them a chance to kind of shine in the classroom.
Why do you focus on military kids in particular? What's different about their experiences and their circumstances?
Right, that's a great question. So military kids, like any other kid, goes through developmental, like adolescents, so they, you know, physically, mentally. And that's a stress in and of itself. And then on top of that, if they have a family member who is deployed or gone for long periods of training, that can compound and cause increased anxiety or opposite depression. So there was a study in 2013 that compared military kids to non-military kids of the same age, and they found that they're 3 times more likely to experience anxiety and depression and 50% more likely to attempt suicide. So when I researched this,
Oh, Cindy, are you there? And we are continuing to have problems with Cindy's line. We're talking right now with Cindy Brosig. She has served 9 years active duty in the U.S. Army Nurse Corps. She used her GI Bill benefits to earn a master's degree in nursing with an emphasis on as we're trying to get her back on animal-assisted therapy. And she and her dog, Ted, are a registered therapy dog team. She has Operation Heal that is based right here in Wisconsin, and she is actively involved in classrooms where there are military children, and she works with those classrooms through her therapy dog team, Ted. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you had interaction with a therapy dog, with perhaps through an animal-assisted therapy program to nurture children in a holistic way? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. What's that experience been like? Has a therapy dog changed your family? Are you a veteran who has found healing, who has found strength through a therapy animal? Call in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Cindy, are you back on the line?
Yes. I don't know why I'm having such trouble this morning.
So explain to us, how did you first connect Ted with Wisconsin military families? What's the connection there?
My husband serves in the Army National Guard here in Madison. And so we started introducing, I was part of the family readiness group. And so I thought it would be nice to start incorporating him into some of our programs. We had a large deployment scheduled, and it was just perfect timing, perfect and imperfect probably, for since families were going to be missing their service members. So we played a role as far as going to yellow ribbon ceremonies, which usually take place outside of the military facility. And so it was a nice place to calm kids' nerves while the parents and the service members could focus on paperwork and getting ready for the deployment.
Oh, so the kids could go and interact with Ted while their parents might be doing some other work.
Absolutely. We talked about feelings. We talked about what they might experience during their parents' absence. And we also on site had the family support program, which always includes either a counselor. So it was a great connection for kids, a lot of support for them.
What about active duty military families or veterans made you realize that this was a way you and Ted could be of service, could make a difference?
I have to say, by supporting military families, in turn, you're supporting that service member who may not be at home or around to help out. I know from personal experience, when my husband deployed, I had to, you know, revamp. It was making sure that the kids were getting to school and taking care of the household, but not letting my husband know that I was stressed. So I was stubborn. I would lie to him saying everything's fine at home because I knew if I complained to him and said there were problems and, you know, my kid or one of, you know, our son was maybe crying so much. I didn't want him to be distracted from the mission. I wanted him to just stay focused so he stayed safe.
What is your next step for you and Ted? Where will this lead you?
Gosh, I'm really hoping to connect with either other veterans who would like to do more outreach. I'm hoping that I know a big part of why our program works is because of my military service. I'm able to connect with the kids if they tell me that they're at a base and let's say Shepherd Air Force Base. I know where that base is, where some other folks may not know, and I can talk to them about it, and we can talk military terminology. And so I'm hoping that we find other military veterans out there that have a dog. Maybe they want to train it for therapy work, so we can reach throughout the state, really, because National Guard members here in Wisconsin are spread throughout the state. There's 9,000 of us, and we're not all here in Madison or Milwaukee.
Well, Cindy, thank you so much for your time.
Yes, thank you for your patience.
Cindy Brosig served 9 years active duty in the U.S. Air Force Nurse Corps. She used her GI Bill benefits to earn a master's in nursing with an emphasis on animal-assisted therapy. She and her dog, Ted, are a registered therapy dog team. Earlier in the hour, we spoke to retired Colonel Doug Miller, who is the Military Working Dog Program Manager for the Defense Department, about K-9 Veterans Day. This hour, the morning show was produced by Keely Baltina. Michael Derringer provided technical direction. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the Ideas Network.